If you would like to support Community Radio and enter into our 6 grand prize draws, there is still time. Go to www.ciut.fm to find out how. Don't delay. The deadline to enter into the grand prize draws is May 31st. CIUT 89.5 FM. The evolution continues.
Ani, bojo, tanse, sego, wache, and hello. Indigenous Waves is a celebration of Indigenous cultures, locally, nationally, and globally. Through music, storytelling, interviews, panel discussions, art, and humor, we explore the diversity of Indigenous peoples. Indigenous Waves can be heard here on CIUT every Monday from 4 p.m. to 5 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, and you can always catch our podcasts at indigenouswaves.com. Follow us on Twitter at Indigenous Waves to stay up to date with Indigenous Waves here on CIUT 89.5 FM. Ani.
1, 2, 3, 4,
get it! The evolution continues. CIUT 89.5, Toronto.
Collective CIUT 89.5 FM. I'm Jamson. Joining me in studio,
Mally, aka Docu Vixen.
Adrian Worrell.
And big shout out to Kemba King, who is on her way. She's just stuck in traffic.
Oh.
And shout out to
Adnan.
It was supposed to be his third last show with us, but he is incapacitated with a cold.
Oh,
cold.
No.
Yeah, I hate when that happens.
Me too,
yeah.
Especially this time of year.
He's also had like a really on the grind kind of thing.
Yeah, we're going to give him a little bit of a blight, but come on, the cold knocked him out, man. It's
And if you like were stuck outside and it all of a sudden was like, winter again.
The last few days, climate change is real, y'all.
Yeah.
Okay, climate change is real.
I guess I'm going to be the one who has to go in on a non den, right? You guys are going to be nice, right?
You really want to dig into
him. Yeah, this is the dude who walked in here with a torn Achilles, man. Like,
that's true.
You know what I'm saying? Like,
true.
He doesn't have a regular human pain threshold.
He could have came in.
He could have been here, man.
Adnan, if you're listening.
That's all I'm saying.
Yes. You can at least call in and say hello.
Yes.
Jeez. So we're the Vibe Collective. We're heard every Saturday from 3 to 5. From 3 to 4, we engage in making fun of each other and also roundtable talks about important issues like...
Wow. Yeah.
Politics. Toronto
circus.
Politics. The circus.
That is Toronto politics.
Decolonization, social justice, resistance, the culture of resistance, identity... And environmental.
Oh, she beat me to it. That's dirty.
Environmental racism.
Environmental racism.
And other kinds of racism.
Yeah.
All the isms.
Yeah.
And then from 4 to 5, the DJs, that be myself and DJ Griffin, also known as Adrian Worrell, brings you music to move you. And we will be doing that today, but I would like to welcome to the studio our special guest, Sabrina Muella, who is a writer, performer, poet, filmmaker, and all-around artist based in Toronto, Born in France from Congolese parents, she grew up in Paris and started writing as soon as she was old enough to hold a pen. She is an undergrad in media studies and another one in African studies. I think that you might be a candidate to replace our resident academic Adnan, who will be leaving us soon after earning her master's degree in marketing and communication. She moved to Canada to pursue a career in arts, and this Wednesday, the play that she wrote and will be starring in takes place for Rock Paper Sisters, and it's called Made in Congo. Welcome to the Vibe Collective, Sabrina.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Hi, everyone, and thank you so much for having me today with you.
Thank you for joining us.
Yes.
Thank you so much for joining us. I know you mentioned before you were feeling a little bit nervous, but hopefully the tea and the laughs have helped make
you feel
a little.
I am nervous, but you know, I feel the warm welcome from the team, and I have a tea to keep me warm, so
yes,
that's good.
So we will be getting into the politics. I know Melinda really wants to talk about it.
No, I can wait.
Yeah,
we have to. It's going to be ongoing.
we will be touching on that. But I do want to talk to you, Sabrina, about your play.
Yes.
That is taking place at Be Current's Rock Paper Sisters, Made in Congo. Do you want to talk a little bit
about
that?
Talk about the play. Yes, sure. So it's going to be an excerpt presentation at Rock Paper Sisters this Wednesday at 8 p.m. And Made in Congo, it's a story. It's a one-woman show, so I'm alone on stage, and it's the story of three Congolese women, which are Bina, based on myself, Mulongi, based on my mother, and Coco, the grandmother. And the play talks about the relation that they have with the Congo. Bina, she's the one who doesn't know the Congo. She grew up in Europe. She has all of her cousins are in Canada, so she's the child of the diaspora, the Congolese from the diaspora. Mulongi, through her eyes, we see the story of the immigrant. She was born in Congo. She grew up in Congo. She left in the middle of the 70s to go to Europe, and we see the relationship that she has with Congo. It's more, she has a lot of nostalgia about Congo. When she grew up at the time in the 70s when Kinshasa, the capital, was called Kinshasa the Beautiful. It was really those glorious years in Congo, so she has all this nostalgia about her childhood and her teenage years and her country. While Coco, the grandmother, she's the matriarch. She's the one who still lives in Congo. She was born in Congo. She spends all her life in Congo. But she really, she has a love and hate relationship with her country. She resents the Congo right now. She's close to 75 years old. She has known the Congo as she has known the colonization. She has known the Congo when it was still colonized by Belgian people. She has seen World War II. She has seen civil wars. I don't know how many civil wars, maybe three or four. She's seeing what's happening right now in the country. And so she has lost some of her daughter. She has lost some of her children. So she's really... she's pissed off. She kind of wants Congo to get it together. So we see all these three different views of the Congo. So it's a really a deep and emotional story. But there's a lot of laughter. There's tears and laughter, and it's really told in the African way, the African tradition of storytelling. So there's a lot of proverbs, music, dances. All in that. I don't want to tell too much, but it's going to be great.
And this is your first play, correct?
This is my very first play, yes. Yes. So you want to know the story about the play? Why
yes.
I wrote it?
Yes.
Because to me, it's a play that I want to see, and I was waiting for someone else to write it. Every time I would go to the theater, I was like, oh, how come we don't have... stories from the Congo written by the Congolese, because the story of the play, I feel like there's a tradition in the media and in the literature to talk about Congo from only one point of view, from an external point of view, since Heart of Darkness from Joseph Conrad. It's really the dark continent, the Congo, little Congolese people, some savage, wild people, little evil people, since Heart of Darkness. So, and even in the media today, on TV, There's the play Rune by Lino Tejt that had the Pulitzer Prize, and that was in Toronto 3 years ago, and I thought I was the only one who hated that play, but maybe not.
I was going to ask you about that. I noticed you had a poem written that was seemed to be in response to Linotage's.
Linotage, like, God bless her. I really love all of her other plays, but I felt like, again, she felt in that trap of looking at Congolese women from a very westernized lens and westernized point of view, and you see them as being victims, as being like powerless. Again, like the way the Congolese men are described, it's not. When I was looking at it, I was like, that's not the Congo that I know. Like, is my family really like exceptional that we were not like what I see on stage? Or even there's the film War Witch, Rebelle, who had who was nominated for an Academy Award, who had all these awards here in Canada. And I was happy that the two Congolese lead actors got the Canadian Screen Awards for their performance, because they were wonderful. But again, the story was written from a person who's not from the Congo, from someone who is like external to the story. And I was always thinking, where are the African voices? Where are the Congolese voices? Like, to bring some kind of balance, because we like, it's like we're in 3D, but we all only see one dimension of the Congolese woman. And I was always comparing it to when I read stories from Nigeria, because we are not that far, Congo, Nigeria, we're not that far. But in Nigeria, you have Chinua Achebe, you have Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie. And when you read a book like Half of the Yellow Sun, and Chimamanda talks about the war in Biafra, the story that she tells, like, you know, that she like she interviewed her family, she goes really deep, and it's not, it has nothing to do with what someone outside from the country or from a westernized tradition would write. So I was always thinking, how come someone doesn't write that about Congo? How come all we have is those, I'm tired of hearing those children in the war, blah, 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 and it's written by someone who's not from there, but say, oh yeah, maybe I've been there, I've interviewed like two or three child in the street and whatever, and I'm like, that's not the stories. And then I realized, well, I have all these stories from my mother, my grandmother, from my dad, my granddad, and they've been through the war. My mom, she was in a refugee camp organized by the United Nations. And I was like, oh, that's interesting. And it's only not as an adult, I was like, oh, mom, how was it to be in the camp? And asking my grandmother and my dad, oh, how was it to be in the war and you were a child? And how was it? And they have all these amazing stories. It's like you listen to them, it's like you're seeing a film. But the way they talk about all these African stories has nothing to do with what you see right now in the mainstream media or in the mainstream theater. So this is why I felt that it was so important to bring what they have to say, because it's from a Congolese perspective. It's from people who really grew up in the Congo, live the Congo, so they know what they're talking about. And when they tell stories, both my parents, like, they're not professional writers or artists, but they are born storytellers. You're just, you can't stop listening to them. And they bring so much fun. When my mom talk about being in the United Nations refugee camp, oh my God, you can laugh until you cry, because she has all these anecdotes about being young and being a child, and a little brother, he was always not breastfeeding, drinking milk with the baby bottle. But it was the war, and there was no baby bottle. So my grandmother had all these jokes about, oh no, there's no milk no more. There's no milk in the baby bottle. You know, the rebels, they stole all the milk. They stole all the baby bottles. So, and that's how he had to stop drinking the baby bottles, and he had to start, drinking juice or water or whatever. But the way she tells those stories is so amazing that I was like, I think a lot of people are missing the point. So it's time for me to step up and, you know, take action and bring those stories to life, so that the public can have like a balanced view of what it is to be in the Congo, to be a Congolese woman. Like, we are not only victims, we are Congolese women, they can be empowered.
There's a I mean, I think part of the issue, particularly, I mean, representation of African countries in general in North America is a problem and will likely remain a problem because of, I guess, preconceived notions and certain psychological investments. But Congo in particular, I mean, you have Western forces and agencies deeply involved in Congo and into the situations that are created the things that we now are appalled at. Like, I think this week we had someone from the British... British forces admit that they had a hand in the assassination of Patrice Lumumba. They came on and they admitted that.
Yes.
And Hillary Clinton had said as much around, I think, 3 or 4 years later that America was involved. So, like, the idea that you have this politic of destabilization in this area, and then we have certain agencies going to report on the quote-unquote atrocities. Well, I mean, they're real atrocities, but they're somewhat manufactured. I think affects the ways that we can actually... the stories that we can let come out of that place without incriminating ourselves. Mm-hmm. You know, and it's so refreshing that when you hear someone from that actual place doing their own thing and saying, well, no, yeah, that maybe that happens, but this is why, or et cetera, and giving it that context, that personal touch.
Yes, yes, you're so right. And it was one of my big problems with the play Ruined. I felt like there was no political, cultural, there was no historical context. You could only see those people. Sometimes it's like, oh, those black people, those African people, they're always fighting. We don't really know why. Maybe like they're not from the same tribes and they can never get along together. But of course, if you don't give like the historical context, the cultural, the context, the political context, that's what you're left under the impression with. But that's not the reality. Like Congo has always been a geostrategical place, and that's why there's all these external foreigners that are always interested in the Congo, and people have no idea that, let's say, just like the atomic bomb during World War II would not have existed without the Congo. It's sad, but all the uranium that was used to conceive those bombs was from the Congo. And even Albert Einstein back in the day wrote to Eisenhower and was saying, oh, we can't let German people get hold of Congo because the uranium is there and we need it. And people don't know that. People don't know that to go to the space, like when the first man went to the space or the moon or whatever, this would not have been possible without the Congo, because the minerals that were used to create those
computers,
came from the Congo. And even after that, I don't know if it was Buzz Aldrin or the other one, they went to the Congo like to say thank you to the people. So there's all these important information that people have no idea, because the mainstream media always present Congo as this poor country, like, you know, they have nothing, we don't know what how they survive over there, when there's all these resources that are so important. Like we could not even have iPhone, iPad and all these computer today if it was not for the resources of the Congo. But for the mainstream media, for the general audience, they don't know that. They just think that, oh, Congo is this like weird country, still like the heart of the darkness, the dark continent, and those white people. But the reason why there are all these wars and all these struggles in Congo is because those resources are so important. Mm-hmm. Like going to space, World War II, computer, like the money that multinationals make every day through Congo, it's billions and billions of dollars. So it's too important. And that's why you have someone like Patrice Lumumba who was killed, assassinated, because he wanted the resources of the Congo to benefit the people of the Congo. But, you know, American, UK, and all of these people, they didn't want that, because we need these resources here in Europe or in the States. So, but then, because history is not written by the people who are in Africa, no, all that history, all that is kept is just, oh, yes, well, they had a president. Maybe there was a tribal war, he was assassinated, and that's it. But that's not the real story. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Kemba, why don't we just welcome you to the microphone?
Hello. There's a wedding today.
There's always a wedding.
Yeah, but there wasn't one last week, so no, I got thrown off.
We're in wedding season now. Yeah. Expect it every weekend until November. So, yes, you, go ahead.
Oh, I guess, have we talked about process? Because I missed
we
the first time.
We haven't really. We got into a little bit about the fact that this is Sabrina's first play.
Yeah.
And that, you know, it was about
three
filling
generations.
A void, yeah. Filling a void, filling because, a you know, there aren't a lot of voices heard over here in the West from the Congo. It's often based on, you know, what people learned from the ancient novel of Heart of Darkness, Hearts of Darkness by Joseph Conrad, and she talked a little bit about, you know, how Nigeria has some prominent voices, but she wanted to represent the Congo. So
yeah, here we are. I guess. Well, thank you for coming.
Thank you for inviting me.
Yeah, and I guess I want to talk about your process in terms of writing this play. I mean, from what I just heard, you were talking about it from a very personal standpoint, but
yes.
How did you go through the process of writing your story? And when I say your, I mean inclusive of your legacy of your parents and your grandparents. Was that painful for you to do?
It was very painful, very painful. I think it's one of the pieces that I had the much difficulty writing. Because I was supposed to write, I knew I had the deadlines, and I was always like procrastinating or doing something else or something else. Like the pieces were in my mind, but it was very painful to just bring them to life. And I was working with my dramaturg, and she was like, send me something. Her name is Diane Murray Bridge. And I was like, no. And when I write like my first draft, because the play is in English, but there's some like sentences in French here and there. There's some Lingala, there's some Swahili. So really my first draft, it was a mix of English, French, Kiswahili, Lingala, Chiluba, it was like all on the papers. I'm like, how am I going to make sense of that? I don't know. And she was like, Diane, who's the director, as well, she was like, no, keep writing, you know, we're going to get there. And I started by writing the one that I know the best. So I started with the character of Bina as a child, the little child, Bina being in France. And then I wrote her mother, Mulongi, because that's my mother. I know her well. And for some reason, then I didn't want to write the grandmother. And I was telling Diana, I don't know, I think for this presentation, let's just focus on Bina and Mulongi, on the daughter. And the mother, I don't know, I don't feel like writing the grandmother. I won't have time. And Diane really insisted, no, write her, even if it's just a draft, and let's see what we do about it. And I wrote her, and it was very painful because she's been through so much, and writing like the thing about like colonization and the refugee camp and having like her daughters died. Like when I started the play, that was the end of 2012, I think like I was still writing on a superficial level. And February 2013, one of my auntie died, like my mom's sister, younger sister. And so my grandmother was really like in pain. So I had to think about, okay, what is it for a mother to lose one of her child? Because in the natural way of things, like the parents should go before the children. Mm-hmm. And here you have that woman, my grandmother, who has lost two of our daughters, who has lost her husband, who has been through like wars and through like things that I can barely describe. But then writing her, I realized, oh my God, she's a survivor. Like when you talk to her, my grandmother, she can scare the hell out of you. She's very powerful. She's teeny tiny, but she has like so much strength, like emanating from her body. And she speaks, I don't know how many languages, maybe like five or six different African languages, and she speaks French as well. And she's like, she's this old woman, but she has all like her mind is intact, like her brain functions so fast. And And yeah, this play made me realize, oh my God, she's a survivor. She never presents herself as a victim. Oh my God, my husband is dead, or I've been through the war, or whatever. No, she's like, she stands tall, and she's proud of her country. She's proud of her legacy, proud of her family. And I was like, that for me is the image of the Congolese woman. And people have no idea. People just want to see her or other people, other Congolese as just those victims. It's almost, you know, the colonial way of seeing people. The African is this little child. Oh, you know, the African is still the child. There's still some paternalism. But with my grandmother, I realized, no, she here's a strong woman. And I know so many of my other like grand aunties or aunties who are like this. And in that play, I wanted to give the voice back to the woman, because talking about Africa, like most of the time we see like the strong African man, or there's the image of the African man with this machete or with this gun machine, blah, 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 blah. Like we see in War, which is like always the African man. It's like he's almost a beast. He doesn't talk. It's all about like using his gun machine and stuff. Even though like my uncles are not like this, I don't know where they find those stereotypes.
Do you think that with because you're looking at three generations of yes. women and three different relationships to the Congo.
Yes.
Do you feel like with the excerpt that people will be able to see the multi-layered personalities within that? Or do you think that will develop as you develop more of the play?
We're trying. They will see. They will see the multi-layered, because I will play I will present the three mm-hmm. personages on stage on Wednesday. But really, with the full play, because I've written the full play, so we work on that, and it was really hard for us to pick just the scenes so that something is it's so that we have a shorter version to present this Wednesday. But definitely, we had to make some cut, so there are some things that you're not going to see on Wednesday, but you will see that in the longer version. There's like some layers and some events and some things that I'll develop. I'll go back to that later. But really, you're going to be able to see some layers, definitely. And there's some interesting things. Like I like to be a little controversial sometimes. So we'll see. Some scenes I'm wondering how they're going to be received. We'll see, because when I talk about my mom and our relation with the Congo, I talk a lot about the immigrant experience, the immigration, and how it is, how it was to be in France, how it is still a little bit. But because in the play you see her when she immigrates to France, when she decides like to travel, and people have this idea that when Africans come to Europe or come to the US, it's to have a better life. Well, that's the idea, like to be better. But the case of my mother, it was different. My mom came from like a family who had like money. She was like great, like she loved the Congo. It was great. And next thing she knows, she's in France. It's like the middle of the 70s. There's not a lot of people of color. People look at her in the street, like point at her, like the color monkey or gorilla, cheetah, whatever. She can barely work, because she's an immigrant. She's a resident in France, but she's not a French citizen. And back in the day, so you could not like register for university, or you could not be like, she wanted to be a nurse, or she couldn't go to nurse school because they're like, oh, you're not French, it's not gonna work. So for her, it was the opposite. Like coming to Europe, it was like it broke her heart, because it was so difficult. But then, because she had her children in Europe, and like me and my brother and sister, so we were French, so she felt like, oh, they're so French, like I can't go back. And then while we were there, then the situation in Congo just like it became like worse and worse. So she felt like stuck in France. But for her, it was not this idea that, ooh, you go to France and it's going to be so amazing. That's what she was thinking. But she came, it was like a cold, cold shower, like a wake-up call. She used to cry every day. She used to cry herself to sleep. She used to And she was telling me all these stories how back in the day, no, we have internet. We have, if you want to make a phone call to Africa, you can buy like a cheap $5 phone card, you call Africa. And so for me, when I was interviewing my mom, then I realized, oh my God, in 1970-something, she could not call home, to make a call to Africa was 1 month's salary. So maybe she will call once to say, I'm okay, and it will last only like 2 seconds. Oh. You have to cut, and it's 1 month's salary. And I'm like, really? And she's like, yeah. And there was no internet. The letters, so she would write letters to her parents, and letters took 4 weeks to go from Paris to Congo, 4 weeks. So it seems like nothing, but when you're alone in another country and you have no news from your family and you have to wait 4 weeks. And she was explaining me when she would see like a letter from her parents with like the Congolese stamp, she would like start to jump and dance and almost like she want to kiss the guy from Canada Post, well, Paris Post, because she's like, oh my God, a letter from Congo. And she would like read it. And the same for our parents, it was so hard because they had to wait 4 weeks for the news to arrive. So it was a really different context. I think that for people who know, like, go through immigration, it's different because you can buy like phone card for $5. You can know all my cousins are on Facebook. My grandma, she has a cell phone. Like, can you believe it? She had a cell phone before me. You go on Facebook. If I want to talk to my cousin who are my age but who are living in the Congo, we go on Facebook. Hey, what's up? Hey, how are you? Blah, blah. In the 70s, it was not like this. You were really isolated. And my mom was not ready for racism. Like, she was thinking that she would be like welcome in France. So it was like, whoa, these people don't want me there. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I just have to go to a quick break, and I do want to remind our listeners that you're listening to The Vibe Collective. We are speaking with writer, artist, performer, poet, filmmaker Sabrina Mwela, speaking about Made in Congo, which is taking place this Wednesday at Rock Paper Sisters at Witchwood Barns.
Mm-hmm. Witchwood Barns, 601 yes. Christie Street.
Yes, and it's a one-woman play written by Sabrina. And so we're going to go to a very brief break, and when we come back, we're going to continue talking with Sabrina here on The Vibe Collective, CIUT 89.5 FM.
Did you know you can listen to CIUT 5 different ways? Online, on satellite TV, digital cable, on FM radio, and on the go. Find CIUT online at iTunes Radio under Campus University, or go to the live stream at www.ciut.fm. You can also locate us on satellite at Star Choice Channel 826, Rogers Digital Cable Channel 946, and Bell 5 Channel 970. Listen to us on the go with TuneIn Radio's free app. And don't forget, we're on the FM dial at 89.5 FM. Spread the word. The evolution continues. CIUT 89.5 FM.
Vibe Collective, CIT 89.5 FM. I am Jams, and joining me in studio,
Kemba.
Kemba, a.k.a.
Meme.
Adrian Worrell, a.k.a. Griffin.
Yeah.
Mally, a.k.a. Docu Vixen.
Yes. And we're the Vibe Collective. Shout out to Adnan, who could not join us today. Unfortunately, he got sick with a cold. But mad love to him. Mm-hmm. And we're the Vibe Collective. We're heard every Saturday from 3 to 5. From 3 to 4, we have roundtable talks. We talk about important issues like social justice, decolonization, the culture of resistance, identity, politics,
environmental justice, environmental racism.
Yes.
Can't remember which one's mine anymore. Just say both of them.
All of them, yes.
Yeah.
And Griffin tried to represent that, but I jumped on.
Yeah, she stole.
I stole the line.
Stole the line.
I did.
And we also talk about crack cocaine in municipal politics.
Yes.
Are we going to talk about that?
We will. Oh, yeah. We will have to get to that. Absolutely. But, and then from 4 to 5, we have music from the DJs, being myself, Jams, and DJ Griffin. Mm-hmm. And right now, today, we are talking with Sabrina Mwela, who is a writer, a poet, a filmmaker, and her one-woman play, Made in Congo, is taking place this Wednesday at Rock, Paper, Sistas from Be Current at Witchwood Barnes. And Sabrina's been really illuminating us with your story about your mother, especially your mother moving to France.
Yes, there's more. But to find more, you have to come on Wednesday. I have an excerpt that I can read if you guys want.
Yes. Yeah.
Please. Yes. Yeah. Really short,
wonderful.
Just to give you a tease.
That would be wonderful. Let me drop the music down.
Okay. I'll do just the beginning of the Bina, so not the mother or the grandmother, but Bina, so based on me when I was a child. So let's see if I can like give you a little tease. Made in Congo, made with sunny and warm African accents that make our tongue smile just when we say good morning. Ujambo, abari, mbote na yo, eh? Mbote na bino, maman. Ah. Made in Congo, brewed in Central Africa, heart of the lightness, blood of her highness, pulses of those who are moving with sounds from the deep forest. Made in Congo, shaped in cities where women wear tattoos on their bellies and sculpt their teeth. There is no Lion King in our stories. Someone please tell Disney our totem is not the lion, but the leopard skin. Made in Congo, breastfed with sweet African beer, well-fed with food with magic names like Pondu, Madesu, Bitekuteku, Makayabu. I was made in Congo, but raised in Paris. Saturday evening at my parents' house, I am 6, Nyataba in my hair, all on my skin, I am wearing an African dress made by Mama. Instead of playing in my room, I am watching my aunties in the kitchen, giggling, laughing, telling songi songi gossip. They are sharing their women's secrets. And when they raise their voices to make comments, they sound like they're the narrators of some kind of heroic fantasy. Standing tall, akimbo, they're like, eh? Eh, 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 eh? Maman Chantal, oh! Oh, my aunties, they have colorful wrappers around their hips, gold on their heels, red on their cheeks. I think they're Wonder Woman.
Hmm. Oh, yay. I have goosebumps. That was beautiful.
I know Mally wanted to ask something from time, so. No? Oh,
no.
Okay.
It might have just been my facial expression.
Okay. I'm just thinking about, as you read that, the spaces in which your tone dropped when you moved into I Live in Paris, right?
Yes.
And for you, the experience of growing up in Paris and now living in Canada and understanding the context in which the grandmother's relationship to Congo and the mother's relationship to Congo and Bina, the child's relationship, mm-hmm. What is that a mixture of your feelings towards the Congo, would you say?
Yes, because it's based on me, and I think, yes, you point your finger on the right thing, because as a child, me and my cousin, we didn't want to tell that we are from the Congo. That was something very shameful, because people would be like, oh, you grew up in the jungle, in a hut, or whatever. French people will make joke, other African will make joke about the Congo, like, oh, you have all these resources, but you guys are always poor. Wow. All you're always bleaching your skin. All you know how to do is dance and throw parties. And so, yeah, we will, it's rare, like, we will not say we were from the Congo, or we were kind of very ashamed. We will not speak the language. We didn't want to listen to the music. Oh, it's for the parents. Me as a child, like, when I talk about Bina being 6 and I was going to a school, like, I was the only, like, black child, and I didn't want to be black. I wanted to be, like, white with, like, long blonde hair and blue eyes, and I was, like, writing letters to Santa Claus. They say, oh, next year I want blue eyes. I want so that's why when I first read Toni Morrison's book, The Bluest Eye, I was like, oh my god, it's me. I'm sure tons of children are like, oh my god, it's me. But I was like, yeah, I remember those days where I just wanted to be French. You don't want to be different at that age. You don't want, and I was like so bullied in my school. I just wanted to be like the other children.
And French equaling whiteness, a certain type of whiteness, you know?
Yes, and even my parents, like my mom would come and pick up from school, and I was ashamed of her because she had an accent.
Mm.
And the other kid was like, oh, your mom has an accent, and like the food that we will bring, like all the other children, they bring, I don't know, Smarties, or they have like, and us for to bring things to school, we have like plantains, you have the jollof rice and all of that, and the other children are like, what's this? So back in those days, no, we didn't like that. Me and my cousin and a lot of people from Congolese origin I talked to, even though they're not from my family, some that I met here in Canada, they're like, oh yeah, when we were children, we didn't like to be from the Congo. It was something very shameful.
So what changed? What changed?
Yeah. Well, I talk about like being in between two cultures. And I think with the play, I talk about how when you're a child, you feel like being in between two cultures, it's something bad. And then growing up, becoming an adult, I realized that it's a strength. And now I have three cultures. Like I'm like Canadian, French, Congolese.
Mm-hmm.
I have the three passports. And I think it's great. Mm-hmm. I think it's like I have like a strength from like all these cultures. Mm. Sometimes I can be so French. Sometimes I'm realizing, oh, I'm such a Parisian girl. And I'm like, oh, we don't do this like this in Paris. Sorry, I'm a little posh. And I realize, oh, that's from Paris. Totally. Or I just love my country. I love France. Like I had a colleague who just went to Paris on vacation. And I was like, oh, how was it? In what neighborhood did you stay? And did you go to that museum? Like I'm very proud of my French roots. Like I'm proud of being Canadian. Like it's funny because the Congolese National Day is June the 30th. Mm. So June the 30th, I'm like, Congo!
Yeah.
Congolese! July 1st, I switch to Canada. I'm like, I'm Canadian! And then July 14th, I'm French.
Mm-hmm.
Allons enfants de la patrie! So I think now that it's a richness, and I like to play with that when I write. I like to like what you heard. I like to mix like the different language, the French, the Lingala, the English. I think now it's a strength, and I don't see myself as being like having split personalities where I have to like try to fit in here, in here, in here. It's just a strength, and now I like I'm happy.
Yeah.
I don't need blue eyes anymore. Though I still think they're beautiful, but my brown eyes are beautiful too.
Yeah. So once again, Sabrina Moella, your play is taking place this Wednesday at Rock Paper Sisters at Be Current at Witchwood Barns. What time does it start?
At 8 p.m. sharp.
8 p.m. sharp.
Yes.
And if people want to attend, what should they do?
Okay, they can buy advance tickets for that. If they go to Be Current .ca, I think.
Yes, Be Current, the letter B.
Yes.
Current.ca.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And then from there, they can book their ticket in advance, and it's $10. And there will also be tickets at the door on the day of. I think the doors open at 7 p.m. There might be a lot of people, so come early, come at 7, get your ticket, because it's going to be an amazing night. There's two other artists performing after myself. A great, great, great playwright from Jamaica in Canada called Sébastien Hines, who has this play called Hip-Hopera. I hope I'm saying it right. It's going to be a great night of storytelling and playwright, and just bringing you something different. Me, my goal is to make people travel with me to Africa. Mm. Travel with me to Africa in a way that they are not expecting it. We're going to travel. It's going to be an interesting journey.
Well, based on the excerpt that you read, I think you've achieved that already here in telling of your story and how you wrote the play. And that excerpt was really, really moving. I was getting goosebumps as you were reading. Mm-hmm. Your writing is beautiful.
Oh, thank you.
So Sabrina Moella, Made in Congo at Rock Paper Sisters this Wednesday. Yeah. So, Sabrina, we're going to move into Toronto politics. And
I'm looking forward to hearing that.
Yes, I invite you to stay and join that conversation as a proud Canadian that you say you are.
Yes.
We have some nationalism discussions here a lot on the show.
Every week.
Every week, yes, yeah. As we talk about the decolonizing of Canada. And
Adrian just got ready. Adrian just came over.
I'm a Scarborough nationalist. That's what I'm saying. I don't know about y'all. Our mayor wouldn't be doing that. Wouldn't get caught at least.
Except for the GTA now. So.
I know. Well, I'm slow to adjust. You know? Yeah. And like real talk for me, I've not left 1996. Anyone who knows me, it is still Biggie's alive, Tupac's alive. Fuji's are together, like that's where I'm at. Like,
Biggie would have been 41 if he was still alive. Isn't that crazy?
Wow. I'm 21.
Oh,
me too.
Yeah. 1996. Yeah, right? There's nothing wrong with 1996. Buster screaming, "It's only 5 years left!" You know, like.
Okay. So, but moving into where we really are today, we have a mayor. A mayor who has been very entertaining, to say the least.
Wow. Sorry.
It's been an entertainment. Yeah. It's been a circus.
Anusha gave me a line. I had to credit her for this line. It's okay. Like, Rob Ford is realer than Rick Ross.
I saw you post that.
That's true.
That's what it's looking like. Yeah, I mean, it's like, not only is he like, okay, the crack allegations are one thing. I was like, yo, that's wow. But then it's like, he comes from a crime family.
Crime family. Crime family with ties to the Ku Klux Klan.
Yeah,
like,
I didn't know.
His sister
got shot in the face.
Shot in the face while she was dealing with some white supremacists.
Yeah. This is why I have to come on the show to get caught up, man.
Yes. What?
It was the headline of the Globe.
Oh.
Which was interesting that the Globe did it.
I was amazed.
They were like, what? Bam!
Yeah. Yeah. So first of all, the crack starter campaign that was to raise money to buy the video of Rob Ford allegedly smoking crack cocaine. So someone had donated $10,000.
Yeah, I saw that.
And they wanted that phone.
Yeah.
But then apparently the man who was negotiating the sale can't get a hold of the dudes with the phone.
Suddenly disappeared.
Disappear, right?
I'm really, actually really concerned.
Me too.
Yeah.
I'm really concerned for their safety.
Yeah.
There was a body found in Lake Ontario down at Harbourfront 2 days ago, wrapped in a plastic bag. I don't know.
That happens a lot, apparently. They don't always report that.
It does. But the person with the phone cannot be found. And Rob Ford comes from a crime family.
And he basically came up really strong with, I don't do, like, that's not, you know what I mean? Like, he came with that statement.
You know what? I think, you know, John Cook's comments after from Gawker about he didn't say anything that changes his position on Rob Ford's guilt is perfect. That was the best written speech I've heard in a long time.
Oh, yeah. And it was like the clever use of verb tenses to kind of like cover things up. It's like, I do not do crack as in like right now, this minute.
Yeah, straight up.
And I'm not
literal.
An addict.
I'm not an addict, just recreationally. it's the possibility, right? So it's like, there's a lot of kind of, you know,
look,
it was
what
strong.
What the mayor does in his spare time is his business, well, according to him.
Uh-huh. And why do you fire his chief of staff, man? Like, that's just guilty.
Yeah. Real.
Well, apparently what happened is Tui said, like, you know, maybe you should smoke less crack. And then, you know, Ford got cheese.
No, but
he didn't
say
that. He said he needed to, like, go to rehab.
Which I respect, but, like, wait a couple of days. Wait till after the 27th, then fire the man. You know what I mean? Like,
delayed reaction.
Like a little delay.
You gotta be
strategic a little more.
Yeah.
A little couth, yeah.
He's never had couth. Watch Kimba consulting the crime boss on how to get rid of people, though, eh? That's, no one's booking that, eh?
Like, I'm not looking for a job,
it,
however.
That's how you get rid of somebody. Not in the heat of the moment. You wait till it cools down. We don't think the beef stopped.
I want to say, I've been listening to another radio channel. I'll just say it, CBC. I've been listening to that in the morning.
That's
on the
allowed.
Yeah.
Traitor.
And I actually moved between CIET and CBC, just so that. And, you know, Shay Kothari was on it talking. They had a panel of three people. I don't know who the other two people are, talking about the reaction to what was happening. Of course, this was before Mayor Ford released his statement yesterday. But, you know, the first thing that Shay started talking about was, you know, he hopes that Rob Ford gets help, you know, and I think I really want to look at him with compassion.
Really? Help what? Why? Like, why do you want to look at him with compassion?
Help in terms of not getting caught on tape. Help of learning to light with one hand.
Disappearing people, like, and cutting services to youth in need, like, because, you know, nobody needs empathy for or compassion for them because they're all criminals. But of course, his crime family. Privileged and wealthy and involved in crime.
Yeah, I mean,
compassion for his $100 billion.
I appreciate your compassion.
No,
I really do.
I just feel like if you're addicted to something,
right?
You should. I'm not saying we have to be wholly compassionate of him. Mm-hmm. I think that, you know, if you're an addict and there's a certain amount of paranoia that comes with being an addict, right? Like, and I think the again, this is alleged because I know this is a media outlet that we're at and we're not, you know, at home on Kemba's cell phone, right? The allegations against him, you know, if they're not true, like if I am not smoking crack or anything and my chief of staff comes to me and says, yo, boss, go get some help. I'd be like, I appreciate you thinking about me. This is not true.
Right.
This is not true, right? And here's the strategy that we're going to go forth. I've been advised by my counsel not to speak, right? You've been, because he thanks him in the conference, whatever you call it, yesterday. He thanks him. You've been a great colleague, whatever. Just hold this down until my solicitor tells me differently. Mm. You don't fire the man, right? So within the paranoia, that there's a certain amount of compassion I want to have for Rob Ford.
I don't know. This took me back to that Weezy video, the Carter 3, when they did the documentary. And, like, his boy was like, yo, Weezy, you're drinking too much syrup. And, like, Weezy, like, embarrassed him at a concert and threw something in his face.
Right.
A lot of times addicts get, you know, not addicts, but people who use, they get angry if you get between them and their happy pills, right? So it's like,
it's true.
You know, this
what's true.
I feel like your differentiation between addicts and people who use them, just wanted to understand that.
It's a slippery slope, you know, because I think some of the definitions are, well, as long an addict is a person who's not functional, right? So it interrupts their daily life. People use. Well, I'm saying it's a slippery. That's not my definition. That's how I've heard it defined, you know?
But I think there are a lot of functioning addicts.
But the way that it's
especially
defined
today, you know, there's so many different pharmaceuticals out there.
Well, yeah, but part of it is part of the definition is if you're functioning, then you're not an addict. That's how it works. Like, you can use whatever you want, but if you show up to work on time and you do all these things you're supposed to do and it doesn't interrupt your
then you're a functioning addict.
Oh, yeah, I agree. But that's not how it is often defined. It's like, well, you just have a bit of a dependency.
Okay. Right? All right. Okay. So. Yeah, what you're saying is true, though. I mean, people who are using, whether or not, whatever we want to call them, addicts or not, people who use.
People with an addiction.
People with an addiction to a substance that is mind-altering, mood-altering, personality-altering. Probably shouldn't be in office.
Yeah, and I just want to go back. I think it's a really great point that we came out of that, like, labeling someone an addict versus someone who has an addiction is a very good point. So people who use. So, I mean, I think that's. I'm having trouble with this mic today, but yes, I agree with that because it's you know, it's one of those, you know, hate the sin, love the sinner.
And most people are addicted to something or dependent on something.
This is very true.
Very right? true.
So
very
it's
true.
You know, we all live in the glass house. I'm having a bit of fun at my boy's expense. You know, but I've depended him to the end up here, right?
Yeah. I mean, yeah, and especially if any of us have experience with people who have, you know, that kind of addiction, it's not funny. It's it's painful.
Right.
Yeah. It causes a lot of you know, suffering in within a family or, you know, a group of friends if, you know, somebody is addicted to, especially that particular substance. Crack cocaine is not a pretty sight, right? And we all know, you know, I think not we all know, but a lot of us maybe have had some kind of experience with somebody who has had that kind of addiction. So we know it's not actually that funny. But the funny thing is that when we look at the policies that have come out of his office and the amount of hypocrisy, you know, of those policies. And then when you look at them, like Melinda was saying, it's The Wire.
We're living in The Wire
We're living in The Wire, right?
Well, it's funny because some of the directors and the writers of The Wire were from Toronto.
Oh, really?
Yeah, what's his name? Was it Clark Johnson or something?
Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
Yeah. So I mean,
I haven't seen The Wire.
I
get that response every time.
Whoa. Yo.
Just one day I'll just sit down.
What?
You just got the hiss.
I know. Every time. Especially from communities of color, people are like, you've never seen The Wire?
It's like the one show.
Yeah, and some of your family's from Baltimore. Like, are you crazy?
You gotta be more.
And you call yourself a person.
Right? So.
I don't know.
Yeah.
But my thing, too, is. I understand, like, you people who do the, you know, do as I say, not as I do. So, you know, don't worry that I do crack, but crack is bad, don't do it. I'm like, okay, sure. But it's like, this guy, he's a role model, supposedly. Like, he mentors kids, he coaches football.
Oh, not anymore.
Well, I mean, for the longest while, he did, right? And it's like, then also it's like, people often say of you, like, young people today, they're aimless, they're not this, they're not that. But, I mean, look at the example we're setting for them. Like, we as a city let somebody who... I think people in the city knew that this guy had issues like this beforehand. And even outside of these issues, there's questions as to why exactly you would have this man as your mayor. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But we let this guy become mayor.
But I want to raise the point that he is a Stephen Harper.
Oh, yeah.
Stephen Harper.
Alumni.
Oh, Mike
attended yeah. the Mike barbecue.
Harris.
And... during Rob Ford's barbecue, Stephen Harper, you know, was praising Rob Ford and his election to office and how it's a triple, all we need to do is take out, you know, the
liberal,
Dalton McGuinty office.
Yeah.
And another thing is Doug Ford is gearing up to go for MPP. So, I mean, it's pretty much... They were trying to line up.
But what I want, the point I,
family.
Yeah, yeah. But the point I want to make to that, and I think we probably talked about this last week when we were talking about the scandal in Stephen Harper's office last week, is that what you're seeing is, first of all, the fabric of his colleagues, the people that he pulls into his circle, we're seeing how rotten.
Yeah. I think self-destruct was the term you used.
Yeah, well, each one of them, you know, one by one are self-destructing. But when you look at the you know, moral fibers of these people, they're really questionable. And I just want to point that out to Canadians because Stephen Harper... you know, there's a lot of questionable things coming out of that office.
Well,
right now
with the Mike Duffy thing, right? With like
the whole
and
Senate,
Pamela
the whole
Wallen,
Senate,
yeah.
The whole yeah. Senate, the whole Senate is rotten.
well, and I mean, a lot of people argue that the Senate should not be. We just need the House of Commons straight up. I just wanted to say, I feel like, you know, this idea that young people are aimless, like there's a lot of young people doing great stuff in Toronto, you know, like awesome stuff. And I don't, I mean, when I think about my relationship to Toronto, I don't think about the mayor. Even when we had the past mayor, like, it's not because it's Rob Ford. That's not the character of the city. But my question is, if Rob Ford came out tomorrow and said, I lied, which he's done before, you know?
Like every time.
Yeah.
You caught me.
I have an addiction. You know, I have an addiction. Yeah. I'm going to get help. What happens? You know, what's like, why are
he
we focusing
wins the
on
next
this?
Election.
Right? Like, it's like, or if the video comes out and he, not only is it proven, air quotes, that he's smoking crack cocaine, that he said these homophobic comments, that he made
racist comments,
and maybe there's more information on the video that, you know, that wasn't really realized. What happens? Does he get kicked out of office?
Right.
No.
Right.
He doesn't.
Right.
And I mean, that's the example we set when I talk about setting for younger people, where it's kind of like, do this or else. Like, you know, Chris Rock had that joke back in 1996. You know, about Marion Barry. It's like, you can't tell kids don't smoke crack, you won't be nothing. The kid will be like, I can be mayor.
Yeah.
Right? So, a similar thing. Where it's how do you really use the existing structure to say, well, you know, you should make sure that you keep yourself da 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 da. When or even tell them don't sell crack. Well, the mayor supposedly comes from a family that sells hard drugs however else. So the danger of this kind of corruption and the silence of our city in terms of putting people like this, because people knew, like what Molly and I were talking earlier, like people in Etobicoke were like, oh yeah, the Fords, like yeah, there's a history, they used to be like, people on the street knew apparently for 20-30 years. So what does it mean as a city that we have this knowledge floating around, and the way we practice our civic duty, we're still going to have this person in a position of power?
But that's what I'm saying, and that's why I get back to, and I really want people to make the connection to Stephen Harper, because I feel that, you know, there's no coincidence that he was our mayor.
Well, Harper's in Etobicoke boy, right? Forget, like, he's out of Etobicoke.
Stephen Harper?
Yes, Stephen Harper. I know
he's from Alberta.
He's
from Forest Hill.
What?
I thought it was Etobicoke.
No, he's from Forest Hill or something.
He's from Toronto. For me too.
No, he is from Toronto, though.
There's no doubt about it. He's from Toronto.
He's from Toronto.
Well, okay.
He moved out west, and that's where he got his base, but he is a Toronto person.
He's ours.
Yeah.
But I do believe that it's not a coincidence the people who were seeing these players, these very, very, very disturbing players like Tom Flanagan, Flaherty, you know, all those Senate people, Rob Ford, you know, the people, the Brazeau, like the people who we've seen sort of in these really, really bizarre and comical self-destructive behavior, and it blows up, you know, in everybody's face. But I feel like Canadians really need to pay attention to it, because, you know, these things are not coincidental. It's not a coincidence. These are very strategic people put into place. Now, it's funny that they self-destruct. I find it funny, because it's like, you can't write that stuff. You can't make it up. It's too good. You know what I mean? It's too good that Rob Ford, he smokes crack? Oh.
Allegedly.
Allegedly.
Allegedly. Allegedly.
No, I'm just here to hold it down.
Yeah, I appreciate that. Yeah.
Chief of staff.
Yes.
Going back to strategic and the reason why Rob Ford's in the city, why isn't it Doug? Like, this is what I'm thinking, because I guess Doug is heading towards the province or whatever. But I think if you look at the sort of the career of Doug or Rob Ford, and I don't know, like his health, like if you notice, you know, a picture of him at the beginning of his term and now, it's actually pretty disturbing. I feel like he doesn't really, like, you know what I mean? He was put there because, you know, it was a strategy, but it wasn't his choice. He just wants to, you know, coach football.
Mm, that's interesting.
I don't know. Ooh, that's Ford, my, yeah. I don't think probably. He really wants to be in politics, but because he's from a political. Yeah, exactly. So.
Well, in the article, they talk about the fact that he was.
Which article?
The Globe and Mail article that came out. It's like a six-page article.
Yeah,
it's quite an extensive article on the Ford family and their legacy of drug dealing.
And they just found this out like yesterday.
And white supremacy. although I thought it was interesting that apparently the Ford senior, the father, the patriarch of the Ford family, apparently was very, he found the white supremacist distasteful, and he snubbed the white supremacist when the white supremacist was invited onto the family boat. Anyways.
I mean,
but the thing is that in that article, Rob Ford is described as a natural leader. And that he actually was involved in politics from a very young age. He had run as city councilor when he was in his early 20s. And he was always, he was always drawn towards those types of leadership roles.
Yeah.
So I don't know.
I have to read the full article. I didn't have time this morning. And then, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's a really interesting and good read.
Another thing to me is, like, if you just put on a suit and you say moral sounding things and you do the Bill Clinton fist, you know, like, people are going to vote for you, on a level.
And the things he wasn't saying moral sounding things. He was saying tax dollar cutting things. Well,
that's true.
He just kept saying gravy train. Like, that was his thing, right?
I mean, that's the whole thing. It's like, well, we're not going to waste, you know, anything, we're going to focus and I'm going to be just like everybody else and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Like, yeah. Whatever script. It's kind of like the George Bush type script, and who also had a cocaine habit. So.
And was also handpicked and trained. And
yeah, yeah, you know, similar.
These things are not coincidental.
Is, we know this, right? Yet we still vote for these people.
And no, I remember, I don't.
Well, not you. It's not the royal we. It's the other we, yeah. Right? But it's like, I remember I confronted this. I had a, you know, again, these barbershop discussions, you know, right? The dread in the barbershop, right? That's me. And it's like, you know, these guys, they voted for Ford. And I was attacked saying, are you guys going to vote for Ford, right? And they're like, yeah, who else do I want to vote for? I'm not going to vote for the chichi monitor. And I was like, okay. And so this is now spiraled into this huge gay conspiracy now before the Globe story. Now, in certain circles, this went into this huge kind of gay conspiracy, you know, how they're trying to beat him down like how they brought down Bourgeois or something, right? Ford. And it's kind of like, okay, you're just making stuff up now.
Wow.
And it's just like, you're so invested in that particular line that you will just make up anything to defend it, and also to kind of like
alleviate personal,
yeah, protect your pride and yeah, get rid of all this thing. But it's kind of like, that I don't think they're alone. You know, there's other people in different communities using different types of stories to justify that and justify what happens. But it's really that we're just invested in this particular image and this idea and this relationship to oftentimes other people of color, right? Because you can't put a man like Ford in power and think that he's not going to do something harsh to people, other people of color. Mm. And it becomes this kind of, in a strange way, he becomes this kind of proxy to do violence to other people, you know, who look like you, sound like you, etc. You know, that's my little take on it. And so that's the investment I find that people have in people like Ford or Harris, who won twice, right? You can't win in a place with Toronto without getting the quote-unquote ethnic vote. So how are we and why are we so invested in these types of characters?
You know? And even like Doug Ford's comments after when he talked about this... basically the Somalian drug dealers being a representation of the whole Somalian community. And then he caught himself. He's like, oh, so they say in the newspaper, right? And then Gawker's like, we never referenced their ethnicity, right?
No. So The star talked.
Yeah, oh, all over it.
And CNN.
Every other word was the Somali man.
Yeah,
the Somali man.
But I mean, he referenced it. He referenced it without needing to reference it. And placing that kind of, I mean,
stigma
and this whole thing that we're, people of color are always like this disgrace to the race, like just that reinforcing. And I guess for me, it was a subliminal call out to the Somalian community to say, you know, you should put these guys forward because they're like putting a bad name for you.
And also because now watch how there's going to be a sudden media attention on crime in the Somali community, right? You know,
and that's it, folks.
And it's politics too, because who the Fords run against in Etobicoke, who they have were Somali candidates, because there's a large Somali community in Etobicoke.
Yeah, and who's the boss of the police, right? Like
it's the wire.
See, if you watched, you would know.
Oh,
the wire.
But ignorance is sometimes bliss.
Sometimes it's bliss.
Yeah. Yeah. There was an article about that actually that says no, it's not
ignorance.
That actually intelligence is bliss.
I disagree. I see some ignorant people, and they look pretty happy.
I'm signing with Cameron on this.
Yeah, no, I hear that. I
just don't know.
Yeah. Sometimes I wish I didn't know. Sometimes I'm like, why did I take the red pill?
Damn you, Matthew Progress.
Oh, man.
I'm so sorry.
Okay, so we are well into our second hour, so we're gonna have to go to a break, and when we come back, DJ Griffin, are you ready to drop some music on the people's ears?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. All right. So we're the Vibe Collective. We're heard every Saturday from 3 to 5, from 3 to 4. We have our roundtable talks. And I want to thank you, Sabrina Moella, for coming through and talking to us about your one-woman play, Made in Congo.
Thank you.
Thank you. And once again, for the listeners, that play is taking place this Wednesday, May 29th at Witchwood Barns, 8 p.m. sharp. Doors open at 7. And you can purchase tickets online at bcurrent.ca. And I encourage people to go check it out. I'm definitely going to bring my daughter and see this play. Yeah.
Great.
Yeah. Yeah. So
are we not going to mention that's your birthday week?
Yay. Yeah, that's right.
I wasn't
happy
going
birthday.
To, but thank you.
Happy birthday, James.
Thanks.
Happy birthday.
Happy Earth. Thanks, guys. Getting older, getting wiser. So on that note, I'm going to go to a break. And when we come back, DJ Griffin is going to play some music to move you here on the Vibe Collective, CIUT 89.5 FM.
Your support keeps CIUT 89.5 FM alive. Thank you to everyone who donated during our spring membership drive. If you would like to support community radio and enter into our 6 grand prize draws, there is still time. Go to www.ciut.fm to find out how. Don't delay. The deadline to enter into the grand prize draws is May 31st. CIUT 89.5 FM. The evolution continues.
Urban Investigator here. I am in a city park and I see some strange goings on. Excuse me, folks. It looks like you're training for something, but...
Yeah, three-legged race, a piggyback challenge, then a wheelbarrow derby.
It's called Capital One Race for Kids, a national fundraising event on Saturday, June 1st that benefits your local Boys and Girls Club.
It's an urban adventure race with teams of four grown-ups that embraces the essence of being a kid. Here, jump on my back.
Okay, I'll jump on your back.
You can find out more and register your team at raceforkids.ca or find us on Facebook.
The evolution continues. CIUT 89.5, Toronto.